Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. In our fourth episode on the forest and fiction, it's a great pleasure to share with you my conversation with Philip Weinstein about Toni Morrison's novel, Beloved. Phil Weinstein is Professor Emeritus of Swarthmore College, where he was a renowned teacher of modern comparative literature, as well as British and American fiction, including his famous course on Morrison and Faulkner. He's written numerous books on modern and contemporary fiction, including What Else But Love? The Ordeal of Race in Faulkner and Morrison. I myself was lucky enough to have him as a teacher when I was an undergraduate at Swarthmore College, and later we became friends one year when we both happened to be living in Paris. I hadn't talked to Phil in some time, but when I decided to prepare an episode on Beloved, I knew he was the person I had to talk to. Since retiring from his position at Swarthmore, Phil has taught a Morrison class at Harvard, and more recently in Martha's Vineyard, where he lives these days. Before we get started, a few warnings. This episode contains some racist language taken from Morrison's book. Beloved delves into painful topics, so this might not be the episode you want to share with your kids. If you haven't yet read the book, I strongly encourage you to do so. It's really quite a gripping read. In fact, you might even want to read it before listening to this episode, or listen to the episode again after you've read it. One more thing, since in our conversation we talk a bit about the history of slavery, I wanted to give a shout out to Slate's podcast, The History of American Slavery, with Rebecca Onion and Jamel Bowie. I'll put a link in my episode notes. It's a deeper dive into this topic, which, frankly, we all ought to know more about. The first character we're introduced to in Beloved is a house. Here's the first sentence. 123 was spiteful. 123 Bluestone Road, as we find out, is a house in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the year 1873, inhabited by Setha, a former slave, her daughter Denver, and an angry presence that Denver believes is the ghost of her dead sister. Also present through their absence are baby Suggs, Setha's mother-in-law, who died 8 years earlier, and Setha's two sons, who ran away. The past comes to this house in the form of a visitor, Paul D., whom Setha knew on the plantation in Kentucky where she was a slave, until she escaped while pregnant with Denver, being helped along the way by a white girl, Amy Denver, who finds Setha collapsed in a forest. Setha and Paul D. begin a relationship, and there's a sense that their bond might make for a more hopeful future for these two, who, as we discover, have both experienced real trauma. Paul D., notably, in the torture he suffered while on a chain gang in Georgia, and Setha at the hands of the sadistic school teacher and his nephews who stole the milk her body had made for her infant daughter. Setha and Paul D.'s past, both shared and separate, slowly emerge. But at the heart of 124 and of Setha's own life is also the central tragedy of the book. When Setha, who had found refuge with her mother-in-law in Cincinnati, learns that schoolteacher has come to force her children and herself back to slavery, Setha decides that rather than to submit to such a fate, she will kill herself and her children, but succeeds only in slitting the throat of her elder daughter. This girl, it seems, is the angry presence that Paul D. exorcises from the house on his arrival. But then, one afternoon after an outing to a local carnival, a strange young woman who goes by Beloved, the same and only word that is engraved on the headstone of the slain child, appears on their doorstep. So tell me, before we delve into the book itself, tell me a little bit about how you came to Toni Morrison, what drew you to her, because you've been working on her for a long time now.
That's right. It was very dramatic. I was at my first Faulkner conference, because it may not show to you, but I'm a shy person, and I never liked scholarly conferences. But I went to my first Faulkner conference held in Oxford, Mississippi. In 1985, I was giving a talk, and Toni Morrison, whom I slightly knew of, and I had actually read The Bluest Eye and wasn't too wild about it, that had come out in 1971, This was 85. She's not on my radar. She was giving a reading. She read the first chapter of Beloved. And you could have heard a pin drop. There were 200 of us listening to this magic story. And when it was over, I literally said to myself, I'm engaged in writing a book on Faulkner. I don't know when that will get done, but I've got to know this woman's work. What I just heard is unlike anything I've heard and unlike what I remembered from The Bluest Eye. So the book came out 2 years later in 87. And when I read the whole thing, I had exactly the same view. So I started to teach it at least every other year at Swarthmore after that. And then I realized in the 90s, after my Faulkner book did come out, that I wanted to do one on her and Faulkner. And I actually tried to get her to be in correspondence with me. She backed off a little from that. But we did get to know each other. I went to Princeton when she, a conference celebrating her in 1999 was held. And she was in the audience. She liked to know what people were writing about her. She read my entire book before determining, you know, how much she would charge me to quote the text the way I did. But she liked what she read, and she let me know that. So we became epistolary correspondents. And I tried for a decade to get her to come down to Swarthmore and talk to my students, because by the late 90s, I had invented a Faulkner-Morrison course, and I gave that at least every other year also. I wanted her to talk to that group, and she did. My last year of teaching at Swarthmore in 2014, she came and addressed the students. She was fabulous, and they had wonderful, ornery questions, and she just took them on. And then she gave a big reading to the whole group that night, maybe 1,000 people. 2 years later, I taught a Faulkner-Morrison course at Harvard, and she was going to be giving major lectures at Harvard that same spring. Once again, she met my class despite a very busy schedule and talked to them. And I ended up with an extraordinary sense of her charm, her presence, her power. This was late Toni Morrison. I mean, she was running out of gas. You could tell that at times during the 2016 lectures. But the great stuff is the great stuff. And I think it was done between early 70s and into the 90s. But then unlike Faulkner, this is only in praise of her, unlike Faulkner, she was willing to be, she was willing to testify about the times. Faulkner was pulled into civil rights agitation. I think he acquitted himself well, but he had all kinds of views that gave him trouble and gave the North trouble. And he had other views that gave the South trouble. Morrison, I think, was clearer. The cause for Black people really is, for anybody thinking, is such a stronger cause. And she endorsed it, and she became a spokesperson. She became a woman of culture, a writer of culture. I admired that about her, too. And I had the sense, finally, that in the last decade, she knew her best work was behind her. She was enjoying herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She had a gift for life. Faulkner was a very troubled person. I think she was less troubled. She had more cards stacked against her than he did, but less internally troubled. I think she was clearer about what she believed and why she believed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk about her charm. I've been, in preparing for this interview, I've been listening to interviews with her, and then I watched, there's a documentary that features a long interview with her and earlier interviews, and she is really charming. It's interesting that it feels like there are different Toni Morrisons too, like when she's, I don't know, I'm guessing like around 50, maybe her 40s, like there's this real power, you know, she's a very beautiful woman. And then in her older interviews, she has this kind of grandmotherly presence, which is equally bewitching, but in a different way.
Yeah. She grew with her age into the postures that made sense for that age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. thank you. That was very interesting to hear about. So the idea was to focus on the forest in Beloved, the forest and more broadly trees and the natural world do a lot of different work in the novel. I mean, there were so many things to talk about, but there's sort of three broad categories that I thought we might focus on. And then I'm sure that will take us other places. The first is to talk about the forest as a refuge. And in my sort of faint memory of the book before I reread it, I remembered her passage through the forest, Setha's passage through the forest when she's pregnant and escaping from slavery. But in fact, there are sort of three examples of the forest as a kind of refuge. That's the first one. Then Denver has her version with this emerald closet. And then Baby Suggs has the clearing. But let's start with the forest that Seth traverses when she escapes. One of the things that struck me about it, looking at it more closely, was that she doesn't tell this story herself. It's mediated through Denver's retelling of it. And there are two places in particular where that happens. And the first one, which I thought was really evocative, in part because it reminded me of my own daughter, who is a big storyteller. Denver is telling herself a story, and she's telling it by walking. She's gone to the forest near their house in Cincinnati, and she's walking back to the house. And it's in that physical walking that she's able to retell the story of her mother going through the woods. Easily she stepped into the told story that lay before her eyes on the path she followed away from the window. There was only one door to the house, and to get to it from the back, you had to walk all the way around to the front of 124, past the storeroom, past the cold house, the privy, the shed, on around to the porch. And to get to the part of the story she liked best, she had to start way back, hear the birds in the thick woods, the crunch of leaves underfoot, see her mother making her way up into the hills where no houses were likely to be. So what do you make of that? The fact, first of all, that Denver mediates this story in her own storytelling?
First, just to say, that's so alert on your part. I mean, and you're reminding me of things I would never have talked about, but that are so pertinent. That is, experience is private, but never just private. I mean, Denver knows this because of her mother's storytelling. It's experience of the tribe. The book everywhere shows how this tribe communicates with each other in ways that white people don't understand. A certain noise, a certain hum. They come together, they're grouped all the time. It takes this village to make something happen. It takes all of those men locked up to have the common signals in order to escape from the chain gang and head to the south. If they're not coordinated about what they're hearing, it doesn't work. And when the four horsemen come for Seth and to get back their property, that's a failure of the community. They get the signals and they're not passing it on to her and Baby Suggs. I really liked your different, not categories, but locations and dramas for being in the woods. But the first point is the one you just opened with, which is, this comes to us about Setha through Denver. She's passing on this rememory to her daughter, and her daughter lives it and needs it. Because Morrison unsentimentally gives us the measure of Denver's isolation thanks to the violence that occurred at her birth. She took in her mother's blood, when she took in her mother's milk all at the same moment. The blood of her birthing shadows her life. So that in the social space of 124, Denver's got Baby Suggs and she's got Setha and she's got a ghost. And they're enabling but also disabling. And she grows up in many ways an unhappy, insecure child. And when Paul D comes, it gets worse, because he's going to bond with her upstairs and Denver's by herself. This is where the woods maybe first come into play as release and relief. They aren't socially coded in the same ways that the house is. the house starts with a number. It's got Cincinnati's legal system writ all over it, even though they don't get mail. Denver goes to the woods to be free. And she can access these thoughts. As you quote, lovely quote, that walking somehow stimulates her mind and her heart, and she gets to places that she probably couldn't remember if she were back in 124. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's a space where things can happen that can't happen in socially demarcated space. That is space that the white culture owns. Even 124 is given to her by the Bodwins. And she holds to it. She has a magnificent speech to Paul D that, you're not making me leave this house. I got a hint in my house, and I got a tree on my back, and I'm not going anywhere.
Right.
But I was thinking before we had this conversation of how resonant the woods are in that respect. And I think she's got other writers on her mind, too. She knows she's echoing Uncle Tom's Cabin and the crossing, Eliza crossing the Ohio into freedom, just as she will have to. It's the same nightmare. It's slavery again. I think even more provocatively, she's echoing Twain with Huck and Jim on the river, where they are able on the river to hear each other. Jim maybe has always heard Huck, but Huck hasn't heard Jim. It takes the silence of being on the water to allow non-socialized thinking and feeling to come into consciousness and change him. She's written beautifully on Mark Twain. Morrison has.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. So that's interesting. So do you see the encounter of Setha and Amy on the river as sort of a female Morrison imbued version of the Huck Finn story then?
Yes, I think that it's got female written all over it. What has to happen is the child has to be birthed. Mm-hmm. It takes a midwife to birth that child. Amy Denver never knew she was going to be a midwife. But the beauty of that, for me, the power of that sequence is that two women give birth to a third. And unlike the sweetness of Huck and Jim, Amy Denver, last thing she wanted to see was, oh my God, there's a nigger in the woods. You a mess. Completely unsentimental.
She's racist, but she's hilarious too, I have to say. She provides some comic relief.
Also, despite herself, despite her training, this woman she's just run into is a woman in distress and hours away from her water breaking, and her feet are killing her. And so she has to do for her what Baby Suggs will do later, which is to stroke her body. As I thought about what your topic was today, I kept thinking, because she made it broader than the woods, it was nature more broadly, that this stroking of a body in distress is also about recognizing and nurturing the nature of a person, the embodied nature of another person.
Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of, both in ways that are reassuring and in ways that are troubling, a lot of references to the human as animal and the human as plant as well. Even it struck me very early on, there's a reference to the fact that Setha has to have sex with the engraver in order to get the engraving done. And the act is referred to as rutting. So it's, you know, it's this animal connection. So there's over and over again, there's this kind of hybridity, you know, there's that scene where Amy finds her and she's in the grass. She can't get up because her feet are so injured. And she thinks of herself as a snake in the grass and imagines that she's just going to attack her prey when it comes upon her. So it's sort of, there are moments where it gives the character strength, and then there are other moments where it dehumanizes them.
Well, I recognize that patterning, that imaging, as you talk about it. Certainly, it's all through the book. But I think there are important distinctions too, that it's rutting. What they do to her is to treat her like an animal. That man will engrave that stone, put at least one word on if she gives him 20 minutes. He's buying her. He's being pleasured at by way of her body. And she understands that to be pure exploitation. And she understands it with a certain wit, too, that if she'd gave him an hour, she'd given him an hour, maybe she would have gotten dearly beloved. But she only got beloved chiseled onto the stone. Animals. She knows there's an animal inside her. It's an antelope.
Right.
And she wonders, where did she even hear the word antelope? And she remembers somehow that way back when she was a child, her mother, her ma'am, and the other ma'ams would dance this African dance, which was the dance of the antelope. And that's when she was brought up by Nan, because she had no access to her mother as a mother. And she realized with a sense of humor that that dance of the antelope is like this antelope inside me now. And I think what's so moving there is that that past African ritual that brought them together, that they were like shapeshifters dancing the animal, the antelope, is carried on through into her future. She'll die before that future is completed in the form of Denver, who's that little antelope, so that it becomes a cultural memory that three generations live on.
Am I right that her, were to understand that her mother was brought over in a slave ship? Yeah, okay. I had to look up the history because I was surprised that there would still have been slave ships arriving in the mid-19th century. And from what I read, it was illegal at that point. The government had banned slave ships, but there were a number of them that came illegally nonetheless.
Well, if you think of, I don't know the exact dates, but you've got, this is like 1830s, maybe 40s.
Right.
Slave selling and slave trading was still the biggest industry in America, even though, as you say, it was no longer legal to import them. But that wasn't true in the Indies and the Caribbean and South America. I think their interdictions came later. And there was movement into America of new slaves all the time. We don't know exactly where that ship landed, where she came from. And it's done in the most evocative, non-realistic form, very late in the book. And it comes from Beloved's mind, musing about life on the ship. Morrison has written it in a way that makes it impossible to simply lay it out as a linear plot. But we get the sense that, yes, that's where they came from, and that's where people went overboard, and that's where mothers were separated from children. And in that respect, what lies behind her, behind Beloved, goes further back than Beloved. That scene is in some ways both historical and ahistorical. I mean, it's ahistorical in that it may not be Beloved's own specific history, but Morrison is writing the history of the race.
Yeah, for sure. So this is jumping ahead a little bit, but one of the associations with the forest that I wanted to talk about was with America. And one of the ways in which that manifests itself is in the difference between Sixo and Paul D. So Sixo, we're led to believe, is African-born and has that connection to Africa. So there's a passage where Morrison writes, Sixo went among the trees at night, for dancing, he said, to keep his bloodlines open, he said. Privately, alone, he did it. None of the rest of them had seen him at it, but they could imagine it, and the picture they pictured made them eager to laugh at him. In daylight, that is, when it was safe. So he has this connection to the forest that reconnects him with an ancestral past, but for Setha, and for Paul D, with some exceptions like the antelope, their relationship to the natural world is in some ways a reckoning with the American landscape. And it's a complex one. It's one that involves beauty. It involves love. So Paul D, for instance, talks about loving trees. There's a tree that he calls brother when he's incarcerated in the chain gang. And there's this passage that I wanted to read very early on. This is Setha recalling her life on the plantation. And although there was not a leaf on that farm that did not make her want to scream, it rolled itself out before her in shameless beauty. It never looked as terrible as it was, and it made her wonder if hell was a pretty place too. Fire and brimstone, all right, but hidden in lacy groves. Boys hanging from the most beautiful sycamores in the world. It shamed her, remembering the wonderful sawing of the trees, rather than the boys. Try as she might to make it otherwise, the sycamore beat out the children every time, and she could not forgive her memory for that. So I'm bringing together a lot of different things here at once, but the issue I wanted to raise was this intense and conflicted relationship with the landscape, this desire for belonging, these moments of beauty, also the nourishment that the landscape provides. So there are these scenes where huckleberries and blackberries that are gathered in the wild allow them to survive. And yet there's also this sense of rejection, like Paul D talks about not having the right to love the landscape. Do you have thoughts about that? I realize it's a lot.
A bunch of things. I don't know if I'll remember them all, but as you were talking, different things came through my mind. It's part of her involuntary openness to the beauty of the natural world that she can't get the beauty of the trees out of her mind, even though she's been so damaged in natural settings, and she has trouble in natural settings, but she responds to them. It's deeper than her choice, and which is why it is such a loss when after she's humiliated by the engraver, she sort of shuts off her sensorium. But I think we're talking about her sensorium, that there's this natural responsiveness to where you are that she can't repress. It takes a damaging act to her to repress it. But then it comes back, and she is disgusted with herself for remembering the trees beating out the boys all the time. But that's also part of her being unable to disown the nature that's in her, which I think is the basic story of this book, that natural creatures reproduce. And natural creatures, if they're advanced past a certain level, they pass on milk to their offspring. The phrase that I keep remembering whenever I reread this book is Macbeth, the milk of human kindness. The milk of human kindness, whenever I would teach Macbeth, I would stress this to my student, that's not about being kind.
Right.
That's about recognizing that our kind drink milk.
Mm.
And our mothers give it to our offspring. And what's so awful when those white boys milk her is that they treat her breasts like their property instead of what it is, which is a transitional object that joins her to her offspring. It doesn't even belong to her.
Right.
It belongs to the already crawling baby, and it will to Denver. So in that sense, again, it's involuntary, or it's deeper than voluntariness, this allegiance to the natural world because we come out of it and go back into it.
I think there's also a distinction between the natural world of the past, you know, of the connection to Africa, and the natural world that they inhabit and increasingly is becoming part of who they are. So I think one important example of that to talk about is the chokecherry tree. The scars on her back from the flagellation that she receives when she's told about this episode with the nephews, right, who milk her and I presume rape her, although that's a little unclear. But so the scars that she refers to as a tree. So she talks about how she has a tree on her back. I think it's important that it's a chokecherry tree because a chokecherry tree is, first of all, a Native American tree. And it's a tree that could provide fruit potentially too, perhaps one of the trees that she might have encountered on her escape. So do you have any thoughts about that, about the chokecherry tree?
I haven't. That's why I'm listening to you with pleasure. I hadn't distinguished that particular kind of tree. I've sort of been so taken with the pathos of the back that the scars are figured as branches. And the pus in them is figured as sap. So that what is damaging is also in some completely unexpected and unendorsable way, it's also life-producing. Keats has a phrase about soul-making, that our lives make our souls for us. And most of all, in those scenes we never wanted. So that these are the scenes where Seth's backbone becomes backbone, and it is also always pain, scarring, damage. But that's the backbone that, at the moment of crisis, she'll slit that throat. Now, one could say that's what an animal does. Animals don't do that. That's what a human does at a moment of conviction that what is happening to this, about to happen to the offspring she loves, cannot be allowed to happen. I had to kill them, otherwise they would have died.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, this is, goes back to the beginning of our conversation where we were talking about how Denver mediates Seth's story. I was thinking about it earlier, and I was thinking that I wonder if part of the reason that's true is that this, you know, this central act of violence that the whole story hovers around of Seth killing her daughter, if it's like, it's, there's a way in which it's too much, right? And Seth herself almost is too much. And so I wonder if part of it is that we almost need this buffer from her, even though she's the heart of the story, but there's a way in which we have to come at it gradually. It's mediated in various ways because it's almost too much to take.
Let me add to it, because I think you're onto something so important in this book and so cunningly achieved by Morrison. We are not sure what happened until 2/3 of the way through the book. And the reason that's critical, she's not evading anything. She is modulating how a reader would take this in. If you knew on page 5 that this woman killed her child deliberately, you could not have the sympathy that 180 or 90 pages builds up for her. And doing it through Amy at first and getting the beauty of Amy Denver, as much as she's also a racist, what she gives to Seth, she does the one needful thing. All of that builds in a reader so that by the time you find out what was never fully concealed, but never narrated, that she did this to her own daughter, by that time, I think you're ready to understand who the daughter is, who Seth is, and what they mean for each other. A narrative generating of sympathy has been going on for nigh on 200 pages. To make it possible now to look at something that is unforgivable. And that's where I think she gets into extraordinary emotional territory. You can neither indict it nor forgive it. No reader can. It's easy to indict it. When I said you can neither indict it nor forgive it, what I meant to say was you can neither indict it nor attack it. You have to both grasp why she did it and grasp it, but you can't do that. It's a moment that escapes from the law in the sense that there's no law we have in us to judge it. Who knows what any of us would do placed there? Morrison wants her, I think, in a place where our judgment falters and all of our training that says do not kill is both still intact and held at bay. Because we now know that it is love that drives it. It's love that drives it, although where it drives it is into execution. But, you know, some critics, and I think they're wrong about this, some critics argue that she's no better than a slave owner. This is her thing, and she feels she owns it, and she's free to kill it. That just leaves love out. She loves this child enough not to allow her to be dehumanized by a return to Kentucky. So I think we're in a position that most writers are unable or maybe not anxious to get their readers into, which is, I cannot condone it. I cannot attack it. Therefore, I sort of have to live into that impossibility, which is, I think, the greatest challenge of the book.
Yeah, I think in some ways Baby Suggs is the best proxy for the reader in the story where she is kind of undone by that act because, like you say, she can't condone it. She can't accept it on some level, but she also can't indict her daughter-in-law for having done it because she understands why it was necessary. It's sort of like this black hole at the center of the story, right?
It is. You know, Nicole, she's able finally to say it because Paul D is there and she thinks he understands. This is where the male does not understand. And at the end, he will say to her, "You've got 2 feet, not four."
And that's where we have another Forrest, interestingly enough. So let me find that quotation because I think it's important. So here's what Morrison writes. So it's this in this confrontation between Paul D and Setha, Paul D has found out what happened and she is trying to explain it to her. And ultimately he fails to understand. And he says, "There could have been a way, some other way." She says, "What way?" And then he replies, "You got 2 feet, Setha, not four," he said. And right then a forest sprang up between them, trackless and quiet. So what do we make of that forest?
Well, here's what I make of it. I think we're into elemental differences between a mother and a father. And it's not his child anyway. Paul D's survival mechanism is love small. Love small because you're in a world of enslavement where if you love large, they'll bust you up entirely and you can't survive it. Morrison, I think, wrote the book because she asked herself, what would happen if you love large? What would you do if you love large? And I think the mark of all free human beings, supposedly not of enslaved ones, is that their hearts can love large. So that's where Setha went, and he cannot grasp it. No animal would do what she did. No animal would get the human scenario in her mind that going back to Sweet Home as property and being sold or being abused entailed. Animals don't get that. It takes a human to register what was at stake. And it creates the forest between them because without his supposed anticipated support, I'm actually preparing also for the distinction with Baby Suggs, who has no one. But she thinks she has him. And she can say that. She thinks he'll understand. Well, this is past understanding and past his understanding. It doesn't make her wrong. It doesn't even make him wrong. It just puts them at odds with each other, and he sneaks out. And it will take him a while to realize he got that wrong.
He's also, of course, parroting the ideology of slavery, which is to treat her. Well, I guess, no, it's the reverse. He's saying you're not an animal, but the implication is that she behaved like an animal in killing her daughter, right? And so then the forest for me also evokes the forest that separates the plantation from where she is in Ohio. You know, it's like he's put her back in that role of the animal.
And that animal is different from human.
Right, right.
But the book also suggests that we're human animals in a non-pejorative way, and so we have milk.
Right, I agree. Absolutely. And I think that's the logic that she's operating in, that he doesn't understand, that distinction between human and animal there is the wrong one.
That's right. When Baby Suggs, in this gorgeous moment when she's freed, and she's on the other side of the river, her body's busted up, but that's when she becomes a preacher, an unfrocked preacher. And the moment I'm thinking of is when she says, "These my hands." That's the first time that her hands are hers. It's Setha's free hands that kill that child. This is a free act, as terrifying as it is. Only free people can make this kind of mistake. But it is, you would not want to remove from them their terrifying freedom. You would just hope they're never pushed to go this far. And she is, and look at this, she can't bear it. She does not survive intact her own act, and yet she doesn't disown it.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a tightrope of different emotional and psychological truths at work there. And Morrison keeps them all, I think, intact.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, when you say it's an act of a free person, it's interesting because the woman whose story inspired this, Margaret Garner, after she did in fact kill, I think, one of her children and tried to kill them all rather than have them go back into slavery. In the trial, the question was, should this be tried as a murder or should this be tried as a theft of property, which is just beyond comprehension in a way. But that's the essence, you know, of this is a murder, right? Which also means that this is a human choice. This is a human tragedy in the truest sense.
And yet to call it a murder, at some technical level, it is. Mm-hmm. It's not manslaughter.
Right. It's chosen. It's voluntary.
But not toward any benefit to her. She gets away with nothing. You back away from the experience of reading the book, and I think it's one of the first things you say to yourself. This woman got away with nothing. She confronted the full terrifying reality of her life. She stepped into it. She took it on. And she's damaged by what she did. So, yes, you end up, I think, again, in a place where judgment is both mandated because we're taught to judge that kind of act and disabled.
Yeah.
Because Morrison has put us in a place where we cannot be comfortable judging.
No, and she doesn't back off of any aspect of the emotional journey.
Whereas in Cincinnati, they did. Mm. That if it's either murder or property, or what was floated also is she's insane. Mm-hmm. She's not guilty by virtue of insanity. They don't want to go. No one wanted to go in 1855 to where she was. Mm-hmm. To the drama that Toni Morrison, 125 years later, found. When she read this story in 1974. In the Black Book, that's where she got the Cincinnati newspaper clipping. And I don't know in what ways 120 or 30 years later allows you to see, or maybe it's the first time we get a Black person able to write mm-hmm. it. Morrison couldn't write this kind of story earlier. Song of Solomon is as close as she gets to enslavement, but those are flying Africans and they leave. Mm-hmm. Resistance goes all the way in.
No, I mean, it's very striking because it is, in a way, very much, it's such an ambitious book. You know, it is a narrative that, in a way, is trying to tell the whole story of slavery. I'd like to go back to this relationship to America. So another example that is an interesting one to me is the encounter with the Cherokee, or a sort of subset of this Cherokee tribe that Paul Dee encounters on his escape route. And it's another tragedy that we encounter there. And one of the things that's interesting in the description is it talks about how they have decided to retreat to the forest to wait for the end of the world. So there's this kind of apocalyptic dimension there. So there, the forest, I mean, it's, again, it's sort of mixed. The forest is a refuge for them where they have found a place where they can escape. But it's not a real escape. They're caught by disease. So one of the things I'm interested in about the fact that she decides to include this Native American tribe in the story is that is a connection with a pre-European America that Paul Dee is able to encounter there. So do you think that offers in the narrative a different way of connecting with this land and with its history that these characters can also belong to in some way?
Yeah, I like the way you're putting it. And your last verb is belong. It feels resonant that these escaping Black slaves who will not stay enslaved encounter Cherokees at their last gasp. Remember earlier there were the Ohio Indians who are gone, but whose spirits still know that their land has been taken from them. And they are full of fury underground, silent fury. But if you're attuned, you can hear them. And Sixo knows that the space he's gone to have intercourse with this 30-mile woman is one that they endorse. They say it's okay to go there. And even the notion of rememory is that what's happened never goes away. So the Cherokee are still there. The Ohio are still there. Her way of writing it is to suggest that the land carries a speechless memory in it. And the reason that's important is that the colonial European enterprise is that the land is inhuman and it carries nothing. It has no memory. It's property. It's real estate. It's a commodity and can be bought and sold. And so that was Jackson's premise for relocating the Cherokee. It's just a piece of land. It's soil that has possibilities that we in South, in Georgia, need. And so we will relocate you. They trusted him. They fought for him in the Battle of New Orleans. They thought when he became president, he would make a difference for them. He was the steamroller to try to destroy them. And I think Morrison knows that all readers are coming into this novel knowing something about the Trail of Tears and what happened to the Cherokee. And what it does, in my mind, is that it takes the buffalo men, the ones with the bushy hair, and aligns them with another group that this country has squashed, has done unforgivable things to. And for the most part, they've not survived it. There's a remnant, and they're coming back to some extent. But, you know, once we finished the Civil War, the last 35 years of the 19th century have to do with exploitation of the West and continuing battle with the Native Americans to take away their land. So she gets that too. And I started with the term resonance. It widens the resonance of what's being done to these slaves to grasp that this is an American dilemma in an American locus in woods where the same thing or similar things were done to the natives.
It was interesting listening to you talk the buffalo men. It occurred to me that, you know, this is a descriptive term to describe them because of their hair. But at the same time, buffalo, again, is a Native American animal that they then are allied with. You know, it's another way in which they are becoming what is America, in a sense. And another part of that section with the Cherokee that I thought was really beautiful was how the Cherokee tells Paul D that the way to find his path north, because he's disoriented, he doesn't know how to get there, is to follow the blooming trees. As spring moves from the south to the north, if he keeps following the blossoms. And so the trees themselves have this agency. There's a way in which the trees themselves are part of this emancipation, part of this path towards freedom. It's very beautiful.
It is beautiful. And Setha has a tree on her back. So that to follow the trees is to find your way back to her. I think all readers can feel at the beginning, hey, what is this? 17 years later, he just shows up. He's following the trees. She wants, I think, to just suggest, not make a plot out of it, but just suggest a kind of mythic rightness that what grows in America grows on her back. It grows in Cherokee land, and there's a rightness to his finding her because that is going to be fertile also.
What about the fact that what grows on her back is the scars of slavery? So there's a way in which, like, the physical scars of slavery is also what then transforms her into this Native American tree. So it's sort of like a becoming of what is America, but that physically holds these scars. Do you see where I'm going? I'm not articulating this very well.
I think, insofar as I've followed you, I do think that's a movement in the book. And it's frightening too. All of the book is really frightening. There's a lot of sweetness in the book, but where it must not be sweet, it is not sweet. Like the scene with Amy Denver is never sentimentalized. It's as though, against your will, you're trying to get to Boston to get to Velvet. But against your will, you've got to help this woman. That's the milk of human kindness. It's compatible with scar tissue. there's a lot of pain in it too, and it's surely the pain in Seth that's everywhere radiated in Seth's presence by what's been done to her that just keeps Amy Denver from leaving her. You know, I guess it's, maybe this happens to people as they get older, but you think of all of the emotional experience that dies when people do die, that doesn't get communicated, this terrible silence, but beneath it is noise. They're speaking, and the best writers, I think, let you hear some of that. And the notion of rememory is that you can hear it. It's there. She didn't have to go to slavery. I mean, there she's writing in the 1970s and 80s and 90s and the next decade and a half. She doesn't have to do that. It's that I think she catches the fact that it's still alive in her people, that wound doesn't heal, but it may flower nevertheless. It scars, but the scar is also disabling and enabling. You know, what we went through with George Floyd, this generates behavior we admire the most, even as it comes out of behavior we most detest. That you find things in yourself, there's a kind of elemental, unjudging lens at work here in this book. It's not all put together in a way that would make anybody happy. But it comes together as an overwhelming human experience. They are both damaged. And at the end, he says, you know, let's put our two damaged selves together. We got more yesterday than anybody. Let's see if we can get a tomorrow.
What do you make of the very end, at the very end of the book? So there's this refrain of, this is not a story to pass on. Down by the stream in back of 124, her footprints come and go, come and go. They are so familiar. This is Beloved's footprints, I believe. Should a child, an adult, place his feet in them, they will fit. Take them out and they will disappear again as though nobody ever walked there. By and by, all trace is gone, and what is forgotten is not only the footprints, but the water too, and what is down there. The rest is weather. Not the breath of the disremembered and unaccounted for, but wind in the eaves or spring ice thawing too quickly. Just weather. Certainly no clamor for a kiss, Beloved. There are different kinds of language in this book, right? This is, you know, for lack of a better word, sort of a poetic mode. But what do you make of the rest is weather?
You know, it's a rich, ambiguous ending. Here's some of the things I see in it. There's no need to go down there. If you put your feet in that track, it will catch you. And if you're caught up enough in it, it will kill you. To stay there is to believe that Bodwin is school teacher and that nothing ever changes. And so you got to put the ice pick into him the way you wanted to try and do it into school teacher. It's as though you're arrested in a trauma. It's real trauma. And I think Morrison has the double need to acknowledge it and to get past it. But not get past it in a way that says we've solved it. But the acknowledgement is that we have to go down there because we come from there. That's where her people come from. That's why you have to get the Middle Passage and the African slave ships. That's where this came from. And Beloved becomes an intermediary figure, a carrier from an unspeakable past, literally unspeakable because no one knows the languages they spoke back then. An unspeakable past that nevertheless has fed into this American tomorrow. So Paul D may talk about we need a tomorrow, but you don't get there without some reckoning with yesterday. So the weather is, I think, the book's attempt, you know, the way a dog, when it comes out of the water, to shake itself off and get that water out. Let's move into tomorrow. We can't carry all this on us. And I think that's recognized as mental health. And at the same time, who are we if we keep repressing that? Part of her knows that the more you repress it, the more hold it's got on you.
So before we close out, I feel like we have to talk about Beloved a little bit. Maybe in some ways she's less charismatic because she's a ghost. I'm not sure. But but I like your idea of Beloved as the carrier of an unspeakable past. I hadn't really gotten there yet. What do we make of Beloved? I'm also just thinking of sort of the ghost story aspect of the book.
She's such a strange ghost. She's not a ghost in the American, in the European tradition. She doesn't wear a sheet. I mean, the sheet is there for a purpose. It conceals a body we don't want to be looking at. She's the kind of ghost that is at the same time 2 years old because her mind and emotions are still pre-individuation. She is her mother. Her mother has her face. She's caught in that pre-individuation world and she can't get out of it. She's also got a 19-year-old body. And she's a grown woman.
A toddler and a teenager wrapped in one.
Setha, as powerful a character as Setha is, and she's the heart of the book, it's Beloved that is the artistic breakthrough because no one knows how to write that. What she has done is to go past what realism likes to give us psychologically credible individuals, individuated already, moving through familiar troubles that we can bond with. And so when they go through them, it's as though we did. And that's just the bread and butter of fiction. I think she's done something like this calculus that what happened to her people can't be told in a realistic story. You can't get it all there. A realistic story can't go back to the Middle Passage, but this story has to, because that's where they come from. And so Beloved is the child who was murdered, also a crazed black girl walking down the road whom they recognize in distress and will bring up, and also a messenger from way back when on a completely non-realistic basis. She was there in the Middle Passage. It was her mother who walked into the water. And so she's motherless and crying and in need of a mother. What Morrison achieves is to have this figure, this persona, be all three of those incredibly, but they don't mutually cohabit in anything that we know of as a character. And I think that's the artistic stakes, the gambit that she put on here. We can imagine all kinds of ways where it would fail. And some people even think it failed here because Seth is more psychologically cogent. We recognize her trauma better. Beloved goes to bigger damage rather than the individual version of it. And it suggests that if we want to tell the truth about a human experience, the single figuring of it as one psychology moving through time and space may not be adequate.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's basically an impossible task that she set out for herself here. And it seems so important, honestly, to our moment, too. I mean, obviously, this is a trauma that we're a long, long way from overcoming as a country. But the impossible task of retelling the trauma of slavery, which is impossible in a number of levels, but one of which is simply that we don't have the testimony.
That's right. It's gone silent. It came in many languages. If you can hear in black speech of the 19th century, as in the spirituals, the deformation of an African inheritance as it's been modified to become a version of English, a pidgin English, then it carries a history. But before it gets modified into this English, it was uninterpretable. It was like Sanskrit. Before it was read. Before the code. Code's a word that reappears in the book two or three times. How can you find your way into a code written in a language you no longer speak? I think it's because there's no single familiar shared code out of which this book is written that it will continue to live. It was written, after all, 33 years ago, and it sheds light on George Floyd. It lives in a way that a merely historical novel that's more at peace with its own time frame and willing to stay there doesn't live now is a kind of museum piece or a curiosity, the way Walter Scott's novels are curiosities. This may end up as one, but Wright has had a 30-year history of speaking to people, and it may speak to us differently even than it did in the 90s. It won her the Nobel Prize, I'm pretty sure of that, although they cite all of her work.
I love the video of her at the Nobel Prize ceremony. She's just eating it up.
She's a queenly lady, and she knows how to enjoy life.
I love that. We haven't finished our Forest in Fiction series, but we're going to take a break in the next few episodes, a detour, if you will. Coming up, I have an interview with Doug Tallamy about his new book on oak trees. I'll talk to Chris Schaeberg about the future of air travel and to Margaret Grevowitz about her book on the significance of mountaineering in the age of climate change. If you're a fan of In the Weeds, please take a moment to give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks.